Welcome to SBME Interfaces. Our goal with this show is to introduce you to the people that interface with biomedical engineering, from students and faculty to staff and industry and everyone in between. BME is a broad field that encompasses so many different perspectives, journeys, skill sets, and backgrounds, and we are excited to share them all with you.
Today we're interfacing with Rick Hansen. He's the founder of the Rick Hansen Foundation and passionate supporter of people with disabilities. He's known to many as the man in motion for his 26-month, 34-country, 40,000-kilometer wheelchair trip around the world to make the world inclusive for people with disabilities and to find a cure for paralysis. He's a graduate of UBC with a degree in physical education and was the first person with a disability to attain this degree in that program. He's a medalist at Paralympic Games and Pan Am Games, and he's received numerous recognition and awards, including being inducted into the Champion of Order of Canada, Order of BC, Canada's Sports Hall of Fame. He's a recipient of the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal and has been awarded a staggering 24 honorary degrees. It's a great pleasure for both Miguel and I and the school to have him on our podcast. Welcome, Rick.
Thanks, Payam. Thanks a lot, Miguel. I really appreciate you guys taking time to chat to me.
Absolutely. So I would like to get started with this big elephant in the room, the pandemic. It has shifted perspectives and beliefs and systems and changed a lot of things for a lot of people. How has it impacted you and your work?
Well, it's just unbelievable. One minute, you know, you hear this story coming out of China about, you know, a virus that's impacting so many people, and you see it so distant, and that won't affect us. And then next thing you know, it's in Europe and then the States, and then it's here. And all of a sudden, you know, you see a complete almost 2-year schedule with major events and meetings and activities slowly cancel one by one by one. And all of a sudden our staff are not only, you know, reeling with that, they're also dealing with, you know, what does that mean from a work point of view? You know, the offices are shut down. So, you know, there's a number of things that had to happen really quickly. One, you know, we had to reframe and gather as much information as possible to a very fluid and dynamic situation. Tolerance of ambiguity, the ability to transition to work remotely, and then to also move quickly to digital in a lot of our programs and services. And once we equilibrated, we started to realize that, yes, it was difficult, challenging, and concerning, but equally exciting and filled with opportunity. And, you know, the idea of still staying in connection and magnifying your connections by amplifying your digital solutions was not only the best way to deal with navigating through, you know, the pandemic, but it's something that would be there, you know, as a long-term platform to accelerate exponentially the progress and the outcomes based on your vision and mission.
And so you've had an incredible life and journey, and I know you're not done, but what set you on the journey of advocacy, support, and championing people with disabilities?
Comes from the long school of hard knocks, and you know, there's nothing like being 15, thinking you have the world by the tail, and all of a sudden, you know, you have an accident. You know, hitchhiking home from a fishing trip, the truck crashes, my back's broken, my spinal cord is damaged, and the doctors tell you you'll never walk again. The first big hurdle was overcoming the attitudinal barriers that I had, the stigmas and stereotypes that were very limiting, archaic, and outdated. I thought if you had a disability, you'd have to be pitied, and there was no opportunity. There was no information age, no technology to push a button and find out information. It was all about word of mouth, mentors, person to person. And I had to repopulate that view, cast out those old barriers and stereotypes, repopulate them with new progressive possibilities, and create a whole new canvas filled with possibilities in my new life. Recognizing I was still the same person. I loved athletics. I loved to be an adventurer. And ultimately, I wanted to be a coach and a teacher. And so fortunately, role models helped me think about that. But then I also engaged, and I found that fundamentally there were unbelievable barriers in society, attitudinal ones towards me, and also physical barriers that didn't have to be there. And so that became, in many ways, my rally cry. To be able to say, well, you know, not only do I have to be responsible for my own attitude about my life, but also, and that resiliency, but also to be able to help shift that that landscape socially and physically, so that people with disabilities could actually live a better life and be whole as human beings. And yet still dream one day for the future that maybe when a young person or an older person has a spinal cord injury, there will be hope for a full recovery after paralysis.
Well said. Feeling whole as a human being. That's really the
key. Yeah. This speaks to what I would think is like to achieve all that you've achieved and to come around that event in your life to get to that place. That's an uncommon resiliency and mindset. Now, you talked about mentors, you talked about role models and things like that. Is that something that was inborn in you, or did you get it from these role models and these mentors?
You know, I was always a young kid, you know, who loved the adventure. I was always thinking about a new fishing trip or a hike here. I loved sports, and I was surrounded by family who nurtured that. So the social dynamic of, you know, of that family network, and the friends in common endeavor help shape and ingrain your nature. And they say that, you know, a lot of your nature and life is formed in the first 6 years of life. And so those first 6 years for me were idyllic. And then athletics kind of came in behind that as in many ways a discipline. And there's lots of different disciplines in life, you know, but athletics is one where, you know, there's a great way to sharpen up your resiliency, to, you know, to set goals, to be persevering through obstacles, to define success, and to know that you're working with an amazing team to continue to get better with each moment as you strive to be the best you can be with what you have. And so I think that's kind of where the sense of resiliency happened. But at the end of the day, I was the kind of person who also, you know, was a bit of a generalist. You know, I liked lots of things, and if things got tough, I could always kind of reshift it all and try to do something else. And it wasn't until my injury, you know, that there's no way I could avoid the fundamental gauntlet of what that represented. And I had to focus and drive through all the hard, tough work to come through the other side. Otherwise, life would not be worth living. And so that's when I really realized that you can believe anything's possible, but, you know, focus is the key. And you know, the old adage of 10,000 hours to excellence is definitely born true in something like that. I had to just grind and grind and, you know, eventually started to think of my situation very differently thanks to that opportunity. Became the greatest opportunity in my life, and I'd never trade that experience now for the use of my legs, for sure.
So you've taken this opportunity, Rick, and almost four decades, done great things with it and brought voice to those that may not have. What are some of the biggest successes you feel you've had during this journey?
Well, I think just first of all, just to be able to, number one, make that previous statement, you know, to really authentically believe that, you know, that I wouldn't trade my life for the use of my legs, that I have no regrets. And, you know, I couldn't have said that in my first few years after my injury. It was nasty. So, you know, there's quite a transformation. And again, not only can I say that that's my own responsibility, but I'm so grateful for all the, you know, family, friends, role models, teachers, mentors who surrounded me and gave me the opportunity to learn and to grow. I think the second thing is that I've really kind of recognized that your greatest accomplishments are often the things that are most, you know, most human. For me, it's marriage to my wife, Amanda, my family, being a father with my three daughters, and, you know, and being a grandfather to three grandsons. And what a privilege and a joy. And I also look at the learnings from that too, the ability to stay curious, to grow, to recognize how unique and individual everyone is, and they all are perfect in the journey that they're on, and to be there to try to encourage them when needed, and then just to be with them when you can. The other side of it is to be able to then, when you do have that space in what you are passionate about, is to know that, yeah, that you've been able to make a difference. And I think one of the things that we've been able to do, I mean, while the Man in Motion World Tour was you know, a physical achievement and a bit of a beginning of a social movement. I really believe being able to spend 30 some odd years past that as being a founder and CEO of my organization, of the foundation, and then now be the founder and have a board of directors, you know, a wonderful CEO and team, and know that it's poised to keep pushing down the road and do way more than I could have ever imagined myself, because of their talent, but the magnitude of the movement and the team, no longer one man in motion, it's many, and that's really satisfying.
It's funny you say that. I am somewhat a product of your Man in Motion tour as well. I was there in Expo 86, 3 years
awesome.
Old, and yeah, you're a big deal in my family at the time. So your impact goes well beyond you think. So where you sit right now, you have a really interesting perspective, especially after all that you've done. So in your own view, in a grand societal sense, what do you see as some of the biggest barriers facing people with disabilities today?
You know, it's still number one, awareness of the magnitude of how big a deal it is. Like, because people are often fragmented in their view of disability, they would often see just someone in a wheelchair, or they'd be aligned to maybe their family member has had a stroke, or have a blindness, or a low vision or hearing disability. It was based on medical diagnosis, or, you know, the classification of an issue, or where people are either in the health system or in the transition throughout all the way to the community. So that massive 1.3 billion people that live on the planet today is not really understood and aggregated as a whole, plus the trend for aging boomers, you know, and now COVID long haulers coming through and just amplifying that huge community. And it's it affects everybody. And so it's no longer just a human right, you know, to ensure that, you know, the world is accessible and inclusive. It's a cultural and economic imperative to be able to know that by bringing that community fully into society, the value add of the incredible contribution to economic and cultural richness of life is going to lift us up and bring us and propel us into the future, let alone the ability to reimagine how to architect out barriers that not only help them achieve and achieve that reentry, but it then, if you can do it for them, it can probably affect and help everybody. So mm-hmm. anybody who's in the entrepreneurial innovation space, to be able to see that, you know, you stop looking at the lowball compliance issue, which we should have in our heart anyway, but we should really push up and way well beyond.
Mm-hmm. So looking a bit more focused, can you tell us a little bit more about the Rick Hansen Foundation Accessibility Certification?
Yeah, you know what, talking about how to really attack and amplify, you know, the importance of disability, we decided that what we would do is being like almost like a social innovation entity. We look at big barriers that can have the most impact on the most people with varying disabilities. And then we look for solutions. And what we're finding is that they're all around the world, buildings are being built or renovated, and yet they were not thinking of accessibility. And so they were in many ways re-engineering all these barriers. So you're discounting the value of every investment. And we were asking ourselves, well, why was that happening? It's because it was always being subjugated downstream to the quote pseudo disabled community and the advocates or the technical experts there. But the whole development system in the, you know, in the build and design field and industry was completely devoid of the real qualifications needed to build buildings for people and to be inclusive for everybody. And so that was a huge problem. And so we recognized that there had to be other things that were happening, models to look at. And coincidentally in BC for energy, there was something called LEEDS, and it was, you know, it was basically a bunch of advocates pushing for making buildings more energy efficient, building a standard, and then, you know, a training accreditation program, and then a certification. And we thought, and it, what they got policy, and eventually it pushed everything upstream. And then now buildings are really more innovative and way well past those minimum standards. And so that's, we thought that's a perfect example modified for our needs and for the times. So we decided the most important thing was get a world-class curriculum on universal and inclusive design, make sure that we then put together great, pedagogy and focus for being able to learn, teach, and measure, and then designate, get out engineers, architects, city planners, developers, advocates, get hundreds and thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people around the world starting to be accredited in this professional designation, and then get policy from business and government and agencies to say, we're not going to take any proposals unless you've got an accredited professional who's going to check the box, and a provisional rating to ensure that it's at least gold, well past the minimum standard in law, because we want our buildings to be optimally functioning. And we also know that today's standards can be tomorrow's handicaps, and innovation is going to be the key. And so keep on the innovation cycle. So we're very fortunate that we've got this accessibility certification program in place. We've got about 1,300 ratings now across Canada, 7 different academic institutions teaching the course, including Athabasca University, which is an online global network and teaching university. And so we're well on our way to starting to create a national and then a global standard that will take everybody past the legislative requirements and lowball expectations. So that's how we'll create a movement, and we'll accelerate progress and make accessibility normal in the built environment in the future.
I love this. That is such a great example of changing education to change policy, to change behavior. That is a perfect arc of influence.
Exactly. And then of course, coming back to my alma mater at UBC or universities and colleges all around the world, it really starts, when you're being taught, when you come in and you take your curriculum courses, we think accessibility inclusion should be a horizontal discipline that should be engineered into every curriculum, and that people should be thinking about how to apply the subject matter in that field, and they should come out with that qualification as a matter of normal course. And that's going to be, it's very exciting to be working with a university like UBC that's interested in ultimately achieving that goal one day.
Absolutely. So on that note, as you know, School of Biomedical Engineering at UBC, we're relatively new. We're expanding rapidly with a new building to be completed over the next 3 years. So what excites you about the school and its potential to impact people with disabilities?
Well, first of all, brand new school and a new building, one that's going to be accessibility certified gold, I'm sure. And and ultimately, though, it's what happens inside the building. And what I'm excited about is when you think about, the biomedical field and people with varying disabilities, whether it's at the acute side or the chronic, there's so much potential for innovation to increase the quality of people's health and increase the quality, and effectiveness of our society. And that's magic. And the key is to get the ability for, the staff, faculty and students to be exposed to real life circumstances, whether that, it's in the OR in the medical world, or whether it's out in the community, where are the barriers, and get minds starting to think out of the box and bring in different disciplines to be able to engineer solutions. It sounds a lot like what I do every day and what our foundation does as a thought leadership organization and not-for-profit, but to get a school in a University of British Columbia, bringing hundreds of people together to be able to do that every day, I'm so excited about what could come out of that.
It's great to have your support, and for sure we'll be certified. And we're working on that in the background.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So we have a few minutes, just maybe some more lighthearted questions. You're extremely busy, and you mentioned your family, but beyond that, how do you recharge at the end of the day with all that you do?
For me, one of the things I do regularly is I meditate. I've recognized if you lead a busy life, first of all, is you value your time. Busyness shouldn't be a frenzy. It should be just busy meeting this full and full doing the right thing. So I like to make sure that I carve time off for my ability to settle and meditation. It embeds that time both in the morning and in the evening to be able to do that. The second is I make sure that my health, you know, is invested in as a top priority, not just in terms, it's not necessarily in terms of total time, but it's definitely a top priority because life is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And unless you can bring it and maintain your health, you know, your ability to do other things that you aspire to do can quickly dissipate if you're not careful. And then the third thing is I set my priorities and, you know, and manage, you know, manage over time in a disciplined way, how I do place my time on the things that are important. And one of the things I love to do with family is just chill out, you know, and we watch a lot of crazy series, especially during this COVID period. And, you know, love going on adventures, you know, over to the cabin at Gossip Island. Or for me, I love the outdoors in really remote wilderness areas. So I'll get out on a float plane in northwestern British Columbia and go out to a remote lake surrounded by, you know, wild salmon and grizzly bears and nature and just, you know, be able to hear your heartbeat and feel the energy of the interconnectedness of us all.
If you could give your 20-year-old self any advice at all, what would it be?
Well, buckle up, you're in for a hell of a ride. and but I guess the other thing would be, you know, just first of all, looking back, you know, I'm thinking, you know, good on you. You know, you hung in there on the important things. Don't be afraid to keep learning. And don't ever get to a place where you're afraid of failure and think failure is somehow a failure. You know, I mean, that's a big part of learning. And just make sure that you stay curious and keep following your passion and take some calculated risks. Don't be reckless, but take some calculated risks. And you know, some of your best learnings come from failure. And that's a good sign that you're still open and ready to reach out.
All right. So last question, ask everybody this. Are there any initiatives or projects or endeavors you're overseeing right now that you are really, really excited about and you think we should be excited about too?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I've got these bucket list, you know, things that I'd, anytime I get a chance to talk about it, I say, you know, like, let's think about some things that are seem to be impossible. And let's see if we can get people together to make that happen. And number one, let's see if we can actually get a group of amazing people to come together to see if they can support the idea and the dream of a person with spinal cord injury being able to summit Mount Everest. And hopefully that person is a Sherpa who's had a spinal injury and from Nepal, who the Sherpa community has spent all decades helping people from around the world achieve their own personal dreams by getting up to the top of Everest. But wouldn't it be phenomenal if the world came together to help a Sherpa that had had misfortune to have the re-energized dream that it's possible, you know, that a person in a wheelchair, you know, who's had a spinal injury could actually summit Mount Everest. And what would it take to make that happen? You know, the engineering solutions to be able to put together a core pod, you know, and a hand crank propulsion unit to be able to climb a vertical rope system, and to be able to have the interchangeability of that pod so that first of all it had the heat solution in place, and then underneath it you had various design solutions for, you know, undulating through uneven rocks and terrain and still be able to crank your way through, or when you got onto the snow terrain. And at the end of the, when you get to the top, you just be able to put on the, you know, the wheels to be able to take that iconic photo and show that this is possible. And then, you know, the skin sensors for making sure that you, you know, you thermal regulated and you you had the cardiovascular considerations and the autonomic dysreflexia, and you timed it out, you know, and you put together the team and everybody came around and made that happen. It's possible, and I really would love to see that as a big bucket list outcome. And just think of the millions of people around the world that would be inspired and the good that can come for the people of Nepal who have done so much for the world. The second is that I'd love to be able to see a person with spinal cord injury leave the wheelchair behind and go up into space and be in the International Space Station and circumnavigate the world multiple times in a day and broadcast to billions of people that there are no barriers on this world or beyond that can't be crossed if we set our minds to it. And think about the research and the learnings, being in zero gravity, so many incredible opportunities. And I think it would have, again, a powerful statement that, that the future of space is for everyone, not just the elite astronauts who are currently occupying it.
Those are both extremely inspiring and would have, of course, big impact. And I must say, you do sound like an engineer at times, Rick, so I think there's an engineer in you.
Well, it's engineers that actually helped me catapult myself into winning a Paralympic gold medal at UBC. They helped me build a chair, and that chair was state-of-the-art at the time with a special molded seat. So mechanical and chemical engineers got together. The human kin guys got together, and they all helped me get to the podium. And I love looking at problem solution. It's the only way we're able to complete the Man in Motion World Tour. And anytime you can get a chance to think about making things better, it gets you all jazzed up. And that's why I love talking to you guys about this.
It's great. We're at time. We thank you so much, Rick. It's an inspiration to talk to you and learn more in your inspirational words, and wish you all the best on this journey that's still going to continue for many years to come.
Thanks very much, and congratulations on all the work you're doing. And I look forward to working with you on some of those cool solutions in the future.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care.